place where opinions aren't right or wrong, and where we can agree or disagree about movies, TV, and other assorted media, because it's all subjective. My name is Ray. Thank you so much for joining me. Happy Superman Day. I was totally going to lead this show off with some Marvel stuff, but it's Superman Day. Like, literally today, the day that I'm recording this episode, Saturday, it's Superman Day. And that kind of came out of nowhere. I'm really not great with, like, all of the holidays or, like, this kind of holiday thing, but I get on Twitter and all of a sudden it's like, oh, hey, happy Superman Day, hashtag Superman Day is, like, everywhere, and it's cool. Don't worry, I'm still gonna talk about the Marvel stuff today because I totally watched Loki earlier. I didn't see it on Wednesday, I watched it earlier today, and I definitely want to dig into that, but it's Superman Day, so I think probably a good way to start off is talk about Superman a bit. And I know I've already talked about Superman a lot on this particular show. There's an episode of this show called We Need to Talk About Superman. But why don't we be a bit more positive with it? And, you know, just briefly here, just to start off, here's what Superman essentially means to me. Superman was a character that when I was a kid, you know, I didn't necessarily read the comics right off the bat. I mean, obviously, like I've said before, I came into DC Comics, I came into comics in general, like, really being a Batman fan after I kind of got out of the Archie phase, because when I was a kid, I read a ton of Archie comics, like all the little digest magazines and everything, right? And then, it's like, oh, the world of superheroes, and truthfully, I think Cosmic Odyssey probably was even the first Superman comic that I had read, and of course, it's not a Superman comic, it's just one that he's in, you know, it's him and, you know, a handful of members of the Justice League, if you will. Like, well, really, just him and Batman and Martian Manhunter and John Stewart, Green Lantern. And then, you know, a smattering of characters from either New Genesis or Apocalypse. Mixed in with a little Etrigan the Demon and Dr. Fate here and there and stuff like that with Highfather and Darkseid. Cool. But yeah, as far as Superman, honestly, I think probably World Without a Superman, the, you know, otherwise known as Funeral for a Friend, was the first cartoon of it, or not cartoon, what am I talking about? The first comic that I read, the first trade, first Superman trade that I read. And that's a weird one to start off with, right? Reading about Superman being dead, so you're not really reading a story with respect to Superman himself, but you're seeing the impact that he had on the world and basically how everybody else adjusts to him being gone. You know, freshly from him dying, like freshly from him being killed by Doomsday. And it was years later before I actually read the Death of Superman storyline, the issues that led up to him dying. And I want to reread it. You know, Scott, you know, one of my good podcast brothers at Squadcast Media, about a year or so ago, he sent me the, I want to say it was the return, I think he sent me the Return of Superman Omnibus, if I'm not mistaken. So I've got it there. And, you know, I've read Death before, and I've read Funeral for a Friend before. I think I still have my copy of Funeral for a Friend. He may have sent me all of it. It's entirely possible that he sent me all of it, and I have all of it in there. Either way, between that or DC Universe, I want to reread it, because that was really, like, my introduction to Superman from the comics. My introduction to Superman, period, as the character, is Superman 78. Obviously, that was the first Superman anything that I saw, Christopher Reeve, and it's interesting to look at it now, because I'm in my late 30s, I'm 38, and I grew up with Christopher Reeve's Superman. I grew up with the Donner 78 film, that and the other three, yes, I watched them all. We had all of them on tape, except for Superman IV, The Quest for Peace. We had the first, second, and third one on different tapes that my dad has, he probably still has these tapes, down in the basement. Got all three of those, and when I was a kid, I watched all of those religiously. Seriously, I did. And, you know, because Superman was cool. I never had anything against Superman. The story was cool, and, like, his powers and abilities were great. But here's the thing. Never once in my head, you know, like, after the animated series, and, like, with Lois and Clark, the New Adventures of Superman, and all these other incarnations of Superman, not once in my head ever, as a kid, or even growing up through my teen years and becoming an adult, never did I think, oh, well, this is the right version of Superman, or that's the wrong version of Superman. Never thought, never entered my head. never entered my head one bit. It, same with Batman, truthfully, and I can talk about that for another day, and, you know, all the different incarnations of Batman that I really enjoy. But it just never occurred to me to say, oh, this version's better than that version, or this version's right and that version's wrong. The gatekeeping never popped into my head. Not once did it pop into my head, and it still doesn't. Still doesn't to this day. There are so many different interpretations of Superman across live action, animation, and the comics, and they're all valid. They're all applicable. And, you know, I wish that was that's the biggest message that I wish anybody could take away on Superman Day, is the idea that all interpretations of Superman that have been posited by writers, artists, directors, producers, whoever, they're all valid. Every last one of them are valid. And to be very honest with you, I haven't seen one yet that I flat out just dislike. I haven't seen one yet. You know, is Christopher Reeve my favorite interpretation? No, he is not. He used to be when I was a kid. Now that is Henry Cavill. Henry Cavill is my favorite Superman interpretation. No question. No question about it. He is my favorite version. I love what Zack Snyder did with the character in terms of grounding him in, you know, the immigrant son story and the whole idea of how the real world would actually react to his presence being literally a god among humans. Like, that whole premise and just the, you know, it goes back into the whole idea of DC heroes being gods among men, and, you know, starting telling the story from that perspective. And, you know, the idea, you know, one of my favorite lines in the movie Man of Steel is when he's like, I grew up in Kansas, General. I'm about as American as it gets. Yeah, because that's how he was raised, right? Came to Earth as a baby, was raised by two Kansas farmers, so he most certainly is American. And everything about his core, everything about his morals, everything inherently within him is American, despite the fact that he's this immigrant alien from a dead planet. And I love the way that was brought to life in really that whole, yeah, I guess we're calling it the Snyder trilogy now, Man of Steel, Batman v Superman, Dawn of Justice, Ultimate Edition, and Zack Snyder's Justice League. The Superman storyline is outstanding throughout that entire, and dare I say, in my opinion, subjectively speaking, because it's all subjective, best interpretation, live action, of Superman that we have seen to this date. It's why so many of us are really excited, and or at least hopeful, you know, crossing all fingers, we've been crossing our fingers the last 4 years, that Henry Cavill can continue in that role. And that's nothing against, and I've said this before, it's nothing against this, whatever idea they want to do with this Black Superman story. And of course, we're still assuming that it's a Black Superman story. I still haven't seen anything from Ta-Nehisi Coates that has said it is definitely going to be a Black Superman story. But, you know, details here and there, it's nothing against that, because that's more than likely going to be another, if it happens, if it exists, if they actually make it, that's going to be another interpretation of Superman that's going to be just as valid as Cavill's version, just as valid as George Reeves from the old 50s TV show, just as valid as Dean Cain, despite him being a nut job in real life, just as valid as Brandon Routh in Superman Returns or in Crisis on Infinite Earths, right? Just as valid as what Tyler Hoechlin is doing right now on Superman and Lois. And I know there's definitely, you know, a lot of people have kind of been outraged at the hypocrisy, because Superman and Lois, you know, the gatekeepers don't know this yet, and it's weird that they haven't figured this out. They latched onto that Fleischer clip at the beginning of the first episode, and they're just like, oh my goodness, this is Superman that we want. They haven't watched the rest of the show and figured out that Superman and Lois is a spiritual sequel to Man of Steel. Oh, it is. Oh, it most certainly is. Superman and Lois is absolutely, if Cavill Superman was like 20 years down the road, married Lois and had two teenage boys. That's absolutely what Superman and Lois is. And there are so many ties to it and so many homages to it. It's crazy how the last two shows, you know, between this and Krypton, seem to draw heavily on imagery from Man of Steel. It's almost as though they respect the Cavill interpretation, they respect Snyder's interpretation with the DCEU Superman. They respect it more than the gatekeepers do. They respect it more than some of the comic creators do. And that's really telling how much more open-minded these showrunners and these television producers are with respect to the character of Superman. They realize that it's a tall order. They realize that there's a great modicum of respect that they must treat with the character, but they also are very open-minded to different interpretations. Yeah, they gave you that 30 seconds of him in the Fleischer suit at the beginning, but then they went into a story, you know, for the show. they're telling a very real story. They're telling a very grounded story of family about what if Superman was a married man with kids? What is he going to do? Like, how is he going to approach that new chapter in his life? And it's great. It's awesome. That show's amazing. Seriously. And yeah, the gatekeepers haven't figured it out yet, and they haven't, like, launched into, wow, this is, I can't believe they let him act this recklessly. I can't believe they let him do this. Yeah, he's getting away with a ton of stuff from Superman and Lois that Cavill has been raked over the coals for, or Zack Snyder, rather, has been raked over the coals for having Cavill portray in the movies. It's something else. But they're all valid. Every last interpretation of Superman is valid. You know, and you can have your preferences, you can pick whichever one is your favorite, but they all mean something, and they all mean something to someone out there who has a strong inclination to the character. Is he my number one favorite superhero? No, I am not, like, you know, a Superman diehard in that respect. Batman is still my favorite, and yes, when I was a kid, I was one of the ones that engaged in that rivalry, the whole Batman-Superman rivalry, you know, and which is stupid. It's silly. It's just, you know, mindless kid stuff. It's like, whatever, Batman's better because he's this, or Superman's better because he's that. Whatever, it's ridiculous. They fought each other in BVS, and there are times, and they fought each other in the Dark Knight Returns comic. There are times where they can be at odds with each other and recognize the dangers inherent in themselves and the other, but more often than not, they're together. They're, you know, partners in superhero battling and like, just part of the Justice League, you know, the two charter members, if you will, or, you know, combined with Wonder Woman, part of the trilogy, the Trinity, pardon me. But, like, you know, it just, Superman is a character that embodies so many different aspects of ourselves and so many different aspects of culture with respect to, again, like I said, being an immigrant, being American, you know, pure, you know, like, having the pure, like, American spirit, not the corporatism stuff, not the, you know, the stuff that's like, you know, the actual essence of what a lot of us wish the country, you know, like, could be. And I'm not trying to get political here. It's just, he's supposed to be the embodiment of, you know, truth, justice, and the American way. Yeah, absolutely. Like, the values, morality, but also flaws, tons of flaws. Superman is a flawed character. And there's nothing wrong with portraying him as a flawed character. He's been portrayed as a flawed character in multiple incarnations. That's what makes this hypocrisy. You know, the gatekeepers coming for the Cavill version and other versions. That's what makes it even more ridiculous. Because it's not like the Donner version with Christopher Reeve. It's not like he wasn't flawed. He had tons of flaws. He gave up his powers in Superman 2 and allowed the world to get taken over and crushed, essentially, by Zod, Ursa, and Nan, just because he wanted to sleep with Lois. That's factual. That's objective. That's not subjective. That is absolutely, that's within either version, right? I know that the timing is different between the Lester version and the Donner version, but in both films, he gives up his powers so that he can be with Lois. He renounces his title as World's Defender so that he can be with Lois, and then has to make an impassioned plea to Jor-El, you know, the remnants of Jor-El in the Fortress of Solitude, to give him his powers back so that he can save Earth from the criminals, from Zod and his people. You know, Superman is not a perfect character. Superman is most certainly, and the people who herald Superman like he is a perfect character, they don't get it. I would argue that they don't understand. They don't get the nature of the character. Superman has been flawed from the beginning. He is a hero, and he is supposed to represent and embody the best of us, but he most certainly is flawed. He has been raised human. He has the same emotions and the same shortcomings, the same mental processes that any one of us have had growing up. And that makes the character more relatable, and that really highlights a lot of the stories and a lot of the emotions that I think we gravitate toward as an audience. And it's a shame that there are people out there, there are gatekeepers or comic creators that don't understand this, that don't want to accept that. And you know what? It's sad. And, you know, they're going to continue to spew their bile and do whatever else they're going to do. But they miss the point. They absolutely miss the point of Superman as a character. They do. And there is no one point with Superman's character. There's several different angles. There's several different interpretations. And it is all subjective in terms of how you interpret it. But there's no right or wrong here. You know, there is no, this is the right way to do Superman, that is the wrong way to do Superman. There's none of that. There is which interpretation impacts you the most. Whichever one that is, that's the one you gravitate toward. If it's Donner, if it's the Donner version with Christopher Reeve, so be it. If it's Henry Cavill with a Zack Snyder interpretation in the DCEU, so be it. If you enjoyed Dean Cain's version from Lois and Clark, you know, the version in the show, not who he is in real life. If you enjoy that, great. Awesome. Brandon Routh's version in either Superman Returns or Crisis on Infinite Earths. Either one of those, right? If you enjoy the animated versions by Tim Daly or George Newbern, great. Fantastic. If you enjoy Tyler Hoechlin's version on Superman and Lois, also fantastic. It's all valid. That's like the biggest message when it comes to Superman, as far as I'm concerned. That's the biggest message, in my opinion, when it comes to Superman Day. And people are like, well, Ray, what Superman comics have you... Listen, there's a ton of Superman comics I still want to read. Like, the John Byrne stuff, Scott has been on me for the last year or so about reading the John Byrne stuff because that's his favorite Superman writer. I have made no bones about this. I said this when we talked about Action Comics 1000 on Fans Without Borders way back when. I discovered that I, you know, when it came time to think about, well, who's my favorite Superman writer, I discovered that I am a Dan Jurgens fan. I most certainly am a Dan Jurgens fan. And yeah, it's because I started with, you know, Funeral for a Friend, and then, you know, eventually read Death of Superman. I want to read The Return of Superman. I also read Hunter Prey. I've read that, which is another Jurgens story. And when I started reading the Rebirth comics, when those first came out 5 years ago, you know, I was reading Superman Rebirth, and I was reading Action Comics Rebirth, and I loved the Action Comics book. The Superman book was good. Tomasi, that, it was a good book. It was, and I want to go back and revisit it as well. But the Action Comics book, there was just something about it that was like, wow, every issue, I was like, wow, I really dig this. And then come to find out, oh, it's Jurgens again. Clearly I love this style. Clearly I love what he does with the character. So yeah, I am a Dan Jurgens fan when it comes to Superman. When it comes to Superman in the comics, that is what I gravitate toward. But whoever your favorite writer is, whether it's Jurgens or Byrne or Tomasi or anybody else, even if you like the Brian Michael Bendis stuff, and I know that there have been some iffy reviews, like some people have been really torn, and I know some people that flat out did not like what he did with Superman, but over the last year or so, however long he was writing that book, I still want to read it. But even if you're somebody that does like that, you know, maybe you like that the same way that I like Tom King's Batman. I know if Jordan at Squadcast Media is listening to this, he may have just, his skin may have literally just crawled off of his bones hearing me say that. But at any rate, it doesn't matter. Any interpretation of Superman is valid, and you can enjoy any of them to your heart's content. Whichever one is closest to your heart, go with it. Roll with it, and let others have their favorites. Let others enjoy their interpretations. It's all Superman. You know, just like it's all subjective, it's all Superman. So that's the biggest thing that I would have to say with respect to this Superman Day. So yeah, again, happy Superman Day. Guess we'll start off with that. I wasn't really planning on that. That just kind of happened. Like I have my notes here, like what I'm going to talk about in this particular episode, and that wasn't what I was going to lead off with, but why not? Why not lead off with that, with it being Superman Day? So let's jump into some more stuff here. I'm going to stick with the DC stuff because some DC things and some Warner Media stuff. This is the Warner Media portion. I feel like every episode there's a Warner Media portion of the show. And yeah, we'll dive into some more stuff. I got into it earlier this week with some people on the internet, on Twitter, with respect to an announcement that had been made. And I guess you can call it an announcement because it came from the trades. Just the revelation, you know, clearly things are moving, right? You know, I mentioned last week about how the Muschietti's were talking about the Flash film being a fourth of the way shot, and we know that Black Adam is in production, Shazam Fury of the Gods is clearly in production, they're filming, we saw the new costume, those of us that saw the leaked image all over the place, cool. Well, we got some more information with respect to the future of the DCEU. One of the movies that had been announced over the last few months, and this one actually has a director, Blue Beetle. The Blue Beetle movie that will star Jaime Reyes. We had heard that it may go into production later this summer. Like, late summer, it could actually end up filming. And, you know, who knows if it could get added to the 2022 slate. Right now, DC's got four movies. Four movies set for the 2022 slate, one of which I'm going to talk about here in a little second, just for a bit. But, you know, they could either add it to that, or they could push it to 2023, which right now the only 2023 confirmed date for a DC film is Shazam Fury of the Gods. That's the only one confirmed for 2023 right now. But the announcement came a couple of days ago, or earlier this week, that Blue Beetle is going to be an HBO Max original. An HBO Max original film, not a series, a film. So here we go. This is something that we had talked about with respect to, are you going to do DC Extended Universe films on streaming? Are you going to put them on the service? And quite honestly, this is something we've talked about with Disney as well. Are they going to do that with Lucasfilm and Marvel Studios? Is that going to happen? Are we going to see Star Wars original films on Disney Plus? Are we going to see Disney Plus original MCU films? We've seen plenty of shows to this point so far, but are we going to see movies? Now here, Warner Media is saying, yes, Blue Beetle will be HBO Max. And of course, they went a little further in this article and speculated that that's going to be the same. We knew Batgirl was going to be HBO Max. We'd heard that. And we also, you know, it's Static Shock, apparently, the Milestone comic, that feature film that we heard at Fandom was in development. They were talking about that. That's going to be on HBO Max. And so this announcement comes out, and the reason I got into it with people, if you didn't see this on Twitter, is because, you know, it immediately there was this dissension. There was this offense that was taken, like, oh my goodness, Blue Beetle, the first Latino superhero, the first Latinx superhero, like, as far in a major franchise, and he's not good enough for theatrical. That's so disrespectful. He should be, this could be like Black Panther for the DCEU. He deserves a theatrical release. And it's just another sign of the blatant racism and bigotry from Warner Media that he's not good enough for a theatrical release. Okay, here's the deal. It's very simple. We don't trust Warner Media. I get that. We don't trust Ann Sarnoff. We don't trust Walter Hamada. And we damn sure don't trust Toby Emmerich. I get that. We trust none of them. And with good reason. We have no reason to trust any of those executives. And I already went through my whole spiel about the difference between supporting the executives and supporting the creatives. They're not on the same page. Directors, writers, producers, actors are on the other side of the aisle than the people who actually sign and, you know, write and sign their checks, sign and date the checks, right? The people that sign and date the checks, we have no reason to trust them whatsoever. And the hope, And for many people, the logic, it's like there's no possible way this doesn't happen, is that they all get fired when David Zaslav and the Discovery guys take over and the merger fully takes root. Because that's, you know, we're looking at, what, another, at max, like up to like another 11 months or so of scrutiny with respect to the regulatory stuff and getting it all squared away. These executives should be gone at that point, because look at all of the massive PR disasters and tone-deaf stuff that they've done to this point, up to and including the Ray Fisher situation. You know, the reasons, the very reasons AT&T is spinning the company off is because of their incompetence. No question about it. So it's very easy to look at all of that and immediately assign blame to that for why Blue Beetle is going to HBO Max. But I think that's incredibly short-sighted. And here's why it's incredibly short-sighted. Because HBO Max is not a death sentence, and it's certainly not lesser. You know, there's still a perception out there, and it comes from the film elites. It does. It comes from the film elitists that theatrical is the superior to streaming. Oh, really? Is it? Is theatrical so much the superior to streaming? So what happened over the last 16 months when theatrical went through its upheaval? All of last year, when theatrical was shut down by the global pandemic. And all of a sudden, what did you see? Well, you had to go to streaming. And, you know, I had all these people arguing to me about how streaming quality is so substandard and Netflix is just churning out whatever and it's nowhere near theatrical quality. How many of you can honestly look me or anybody else in the eye and say that all of the movies that we've seen on Netflix to this point and on streamers to this point, all of them are not theatrical quality. Really, there's none that are theatrical quality at all. Because I'm pretty sure I just watched one a couple weeks ago, Army of the Dead. Army of the Dead is a theatrical quality film. I saw it in theaters. That's a Netflix movie, and I saw it in theaters. But when did the conversation blow up? Conversation blew up on the 21st, May 21st, when the movie was released to everyone at home that they could watch at their leisure on Netflix. Army of the Dead is a Netflix movie. And are you putting it in the same category as like a Bird Box or any of the other Netflix films before it? No. You know what? Movies like Army of the Dead and Extraction with Chris Hemsworth, you know, which is a stuntman-directed movie, Sam Hargrave, those types of films, you know, those are signifying a rise in subjective quality for streaming films. And it's not just Netflix. Last year, I did an episode of this show where I watched The Old Guard, Palm Springs, and Greyhound. Those are three streaming movies. Old Guard was a Netflix film starring Charlize Theron and Chiwetel Ejiofor that is based off of a comic. Palm Springs is a Hulu comedy with Andy Samberg and Christian Milioti. And Greyhound was the World War II naval drama with Tom Hanks, which was on Apple TV+. And all three of those films were fantastic. Now, Greyhound was a little different because that was a film that was intended to be released theatrically and it was sold to streaming, right? Just like Enola Holmes is different because that was another one that was sold, made for theatrical presentation, sold to Netflix. But still, the quality has upped. The quality is absolutely upped. And it's not just Netflix upping it. I know people that really dig Lockdown, the HBO Max film starring Anne Hathaway and Chiwetel Ejiofor. I haven't watched it yet, but that's a Max original film that I've seen people on Twitter say they really dig that movie. So this idea that streaming is just this lesser to theatrical, it really is, it's not applicable anymore, guys. It's not a valid argument to make. Maybe you think it's lesser, subjectively speaking, but the fact of the matter is that streaming affords a larger audience than theatrical. Theatrical requires people to leave their homes, get in their cars, pay for gas, get to a theater, park the car, buy concessions if they're available, and then sit down for 2.5, 3 hours, whatever. So if they got kids, they had to hire a babysitter, so that's money spent on a babysitter. Like, I've been through all of this. You know, dealing with all of that, I talk about how you're dealing with all the people and the audience that you're with, you know, whether they're courteous or not. Like, you are asking the audience to invest in so much when they go to the theater. And when that happens, they're going to be very selective about their choices. And I've said this before, and I think DC fans don't want to admit this, but it's the truth. If you are looking at a crowded marketplace for superhero films, and I'm not suggesting that the superhero bubble is going to burst, because it most certainly isn't, but if you are forcing, if you're putting the general audience in a position where they've got to spend money, time, and investment on going to the theater to watch a film, and they've got two choices, a Marvel Cinematic Universe choice and a DC Extended Universe choice, which one are they more likely to choose first? I'm sorry. I wish this weren't necessarily... I wish it was 50-50. I do. I wish it was legitimately 50-50 where the audience would be... where 50% of the audience would go see the Marvel movie, 50% would go see the DC movie. I wish that was the perception. I do. And I wish that it was harmonious and that there wasn't all of this tribalism being forwarded by these bloggers and these writers and these trades and these critics and everybody else that, you know, suckles at the teat of either studio. I wish that wasn't happening. But the reality of the situation is that that's not the world that we live in. And I would bet any amount of money that 10 people that go to the movie theater choosing between a Marvel Studios movie and a DC Films movie, I would bet, unless it's Batman or Joker, unless it's one of those two, I would say 6 or 7 of those 10 people are going to the MCU movie if they're being told to make that choice. So now you're limiting your pool even further. And we still don't know what theaters are going to be completely like when everybody's back to full capacity. We're inching ever so closer to full capacity. Like I mentioned before, in the state of Michigan here, July 1st, we're going to be at full capacity. So we're going to see full theaters. I'm going to see if I want to experiment with this, because I still haven't figured out how I'm going to see Black Widow on July 9th. But if I want to test this out, I can go to a theater and go to my neighborhood theater on July 9th, and I will see for myself if the theater is packed for Black Widow. And that will tell me not only how many people care about Black Widow, it'll tell me how many people are willing to go back to a movie theater again. We still don't entirely know what that situation is like yet. So seriously, as that continues to be where it's at, and as streaming continues to evolve and get better, it is time that we seriously stop looking at streaming as this lesser thing. It's not a lesser thing, guys. It's not. And look, it's the easiest thing in the world to look at that Warner Brothers brain trust and say, well, clearly this is a slight. Clearly they're slighting all of the minorities, right? Because that's what this article said. This article, I think it was THR or Variety, whichever one of the trades it was, that literally listed those three movies. Blue Beetle, Latinx lead, Batgirl, female lead, Static Shock, black lead. All three of them. And they were touted as the riskier projects. And people took offense to that. How dare they call those the riskier projects? Shazam got a theatrical release. That's a riskier one. No one knows who he is. HBO Max didn't exist when Shazam came out. It was theatrical or bust. And I'm going to tell you right now, guys, you may not want to hear this either, but if HBO Max didn't exist, it's entirely possible that not one of these three movies is even getting greenlit. But all three of them are in development, and all three of them either have writers, like, I know Batgirl has directors. It's the two guys that did Bad Boys for Life, which I think it's interesting that the conversation hasn't steered into that direction about two men directing a female superhero film. Somehow that hasn't come up yet. Somehow people, you know, that's not part of the conversation. It'll get there. We'll get to that, you know, especially when details start shaping up and that project actually starts to take place. All of a sudden the outrage will pop out for that, and we'll have that discussion, and we'll talk about it. I'll talk about it rationally, whatever. We know Christina Hodson's the screenwriter for it, right? And clearly she's kind of the darling of the DCEU writers right now, because she wrote Birds of Prey and The Fantabulous Emancipation of One Harley Quinn, and she wrote The Flash, which is currently being filmed, and Batgirl was another one of her projects. We heard that a couple years ago, that she was writing that. Okay, cool. Blue Beetle has a director and a writer. Like, they're talking about that getting going. I don't think any major casting for it has happened yet. But the reality of the situation is that all three of these projects, they are riskier projects. How are they not riskier projects? You know, and people will forward this argument. You know, they'll point straight to the MCU. Look at how risky Iron Man was. Look at how risky Ant-Man was. Look at how risky the Guardians of the Galaxy were. And yet, they were given a theatrical release, and look at how they took off. Yes, you're naming projects that all happened before the streaming age really took off, before the streaming wars really took off, before Disney Plus existed, before HBO Max existed. Look, guys, the whole reason, we said this with Zack Snyder's Justice League, the whole reason that HBO Max exists, part of the benefit is so that it can give life to projects that may or may not even see the light of day for a theatrical release. And it's supposed to be better, because the idea is there's no box office expectation, right? There's no dollar sign. There's no, well, we've got to get it in minimum screens, and we've got to get it here, we've got to get it there. No, it's available to the audience at large. And yes, that audience right now is largely the United States of America, but it's growing. It's supposed to expand into Latin America after this month. And it's hopefully with Discovery taking things over, they can really give it a global presence. Discovery has figured that out. Discovery has certainly figured that out, and hopefully they can apply that to the rest of WarnerMedia and to the rest of HBO Max and get that going. Here's hoping. But the reality of the situation is that this shouldn't be looked at as a detraction. Blue Beetle going to HBO Max should not be looked at as a negative. And I think the only reason that any of you are looking at it as a negative is purely because of who's in charge. You want another reason to be angry at Ann Sarnoff and Toby Emmerich and Walter Hamada. We don't need more reasons. We don't need more reasons to be angry at all three of them. We don't need more reasons to want all of them fired. We don't need more reasons to hope that Kim Masters THR article is true, that they're all leaving once Kyler leaves. You know, and it's interesting, so many people have turned on Jason Kyler, and he really seems like the fall guy. You know, and I argued with somebody else about how he's just made some horrible business decisions and he's alienated people in the business. Well, yeah, he's going to alienate old Hollywood because they don't like streaming. They don't like their movies going to a streamer. They want theatrical presentation. They want the exhibitors happy. They want everything to stay the way that it is. But the audience has been telling everybody for years that they want change, that they want choice, and they want to be able to watch better content from the comforts of their own home on their big screen TVs, where they don't have to get a babysitter, they don't have to spend money on concessions, they don't have to buy gas, and they certainly don't have to deal with some asshole sitting next to them now coughing and sneezing and interrupting their film with a bunch of mindless chatter. The audience has been saying for years that they want more convenience, and they're gravitating toward it. Look at the success that Netflix has had. Look at the success that Hulu has had. Look at the success that Disney Plus is having. Do not tell me that audiences don't want streaming. And you're complaining that this film, which is being heralded, being helmed by the first Latinx massive superhero film in any of these shared universes, you're upset because it's going to reach more people. You're upset because more audiences are going to get to see it. You're upset because now the choice is easier for the audience. If they want to spend money and go to a theater to watch a Marvel Cinematic Universe film, fine. But guess what they can also do? Stay at home, grab their own, gather everyone on the couch, watch the new Blue Beetle movie, and see that exposure. Seriously, this is a good thing. And it's rare to talk about, I know, listen, I get it, it's rare to talk about a smart decision from the likes of Warner Media. It is rare to talk about a smart decision from the likes of Warner Brothers. And I know that we're just conditioned to immediately find the negative when we read those articles. When you saw the word riskier, your brain went, oh, insult. Yeah, we're on the defense. We are. We're on the defensive. There's no question about it. And we have every right and reason to be on the defensive after all the PR bullshit that we were just put through with Zack Snyder's Justice League. That horrible tone-deaf article, that interview that I broke down from Ann Sarnoff, the stuff with the Ray Fisher situation. Yeah, we are conditioned to not trust those morons for anything. We are. We're conditioned to do that. But seriously, we don't need to. Sometimes we do need to pull back. We do. Sometimes we need to assess the situation and remember the opportunity that is inherently there. It is not an insult to Blue Beetle that it is going to be on HBO Max. It isn't. It's not. Because streaming, again, that app might be the only reason, that avenue might be the only reason that film is going to happen. Right? And that's something that even I, someone that, you know, it's the rule of thumb. If I don't see set photos, I can't trust that it's happening yet. And that's still the case with all three of these films, Blue Beetle, Static Shock, and Batgirl. We got to see set photos before we know for certain that they're even going to exist. However, we do have to take into account that it's not just theatrical to look at. It's also the streaming to look at. Would you guys feel that differently if it were a TV series? Yes, you would. If it were a TV series, if you found out the Blue Beetle was getting a TV show on HBO Max, you wouldn't be complaining. You'd be okay. And some of you might still complain that it's not a theatrical, but again, it's just this, we have to get out of this mindset of treating theater like it's king. It's not. It's not. And I don't say, you know, people have called me like, look, we know that you're Mr. Streaming. We know that you want theaters. And I don't want theaters to die. I have never said that I want theaters to die. I appreciate choice. I appreciate the audience being given an option. I appreciate that a family can be given an easier option to watch on their big, huge television with their nice, loud soundbar that they can pause whenever they want, when they need to go to the bathroom or get a drink or do whatever. I appreciate that choice being given to the general audience. I like the audience having choice. That is what I am in favor of. Doesn't mean I want theaters to die, but it does mean that I'm respecting streaming a lot more than it seems a lot of people are. And I know that there are plenty of people out there that agree with me on this and see this as a great opportunity. And, you know, it doesn't lessen the importance of having a Latinx superhero like Jaime Reyes in Blue Beetle. It doesn't lessen that. The movie is going to exist, guys. The movie is going to exist. And if anything, I've made this case, the fact that it doesn't have a box office expectation to it, the fact that it doesn't have a minimum screen or maybe even a runtime expectation to it, could very well mean that the creatives are left alone for this. You know, the WB apologists that I've spoken to, you know, they want to swear up and down to me that since Justice League, none of the creators have been messed with. And probably the one that people argue about with respect to that is Kathy Yan, whether or not she was messed with on Birds of Prey. She says no. I mean, listen, that's a whole subjective argument to have with that. But by and large, you look at everybody else and it's like, well, was James Wan messed with? No, it seems like he stands by the film that he wanted, the film he made is the story that he wanted to tell. Same with Sandberg, with Shazam. It's certainly the case with Patty Jenkins in Wonder Woman 1984 because she made choices that a lot of us didn't like. But she stands by them and absolutely, speaks, that movie speaks to exactly what she wanted to make. And so the idea is, okay, going forward, it seems that that's clearly going to be the case and creators are going to be given their freedom. All right, good. I would like insurance. I would prefer some insurance. And you know what? Being on a streaming service gives me that insurance because it seems the only one that they still want to mess with a streaming movie is Zack Snyder. And that's just because they don't like him. That's just personal. That's just because they have their own ridiculously egotistical animosities towards him that make no sense whatsoever and is, the epitome of bad business in the first place. But the idea that Blue Beetle and Batgirl and Static Shock, the idea of them being on HBO Max, I think that's a bonus. I do. I think it's a bonus because it's going to hit a wider audience. It's going to be more accessible to the general audience at large. And they're going to exist. The fact that HBO Max is going to be... And again, for HBO Max needs original content. Okay, original content is the lifeblood of all of these streaming apps. That's why Amazon paid $8.45 billion for MGM. It's not just so they can get the rights to James Bond. It's so that they can stream James Bond as part of their library on Prime Video. That's why you have Netflix spending billions every year for new movies here and new shows there, because original content is the lifeblood. It's never just about the entire volume of what you've got. Entertainment, much like sports, runs on the principle of what have you done for me lately? That's what the audience is constantly asking. What have you done for me lately? We love what you did, for the most part, back in the day, but we need to know what you're going to offer us for the future. That's how this works. That's how anything in this industry works. And that is the clear principle with streaming. So it actually makes business sense. And it's ridiculous because do I want to get on here and defend Warner Media to you? Do I want to get on here and defend Warner Brothers? No. No, because I think all of them deserve to be fired. But this one decision, this is an actual decision that makes logical sense, and I'm not just going to jump down the whole, and play the whole racism angle with it. Like, oh, this is how they treat the minorities. The minorities aren't good enough for theatrical. They're only good enough for streaming. No, streaming is the prize, and it's becoming more and more of a prize. As more and more millions cut the cord and go to internet only, streaming becomes even more important. This is where the industry is headed. I know there are a lot of people that don't want to deal with that. There's still a lot of people that don't want to deal with that reality, but it's here. It's here. And I guarantee you, this is why this is why the box office conversation needs to get completely overhauled, because you still have people making stupid comparisons like, oh, this counts as a ticket, or this view counts as this. No, it doesn't work the same way. When a movie is released in a theater, that is a one-time windfall of money for a successive period of weeks. That's how that goes. It's a money dump. Whereas a subscription service is a constant flow of money every month. Every month, these streaming services get a check from you, as opposed to one or two or three or however many times you see it at the theater combined with everybody else over that theatrical release period that does not last nearly as long as a subscription service period does. It's a totally different conversation. I really feel like this is another example of why this whole conversation needs to be reframed, and why I feel like a lot more people need to open their minds and really in some cases open their eyes and see exactly what the landscape is changing into. Seriously. So, that's where I sit on that. And listen, you're welcome to agree or disagree with that, but that's where I sit on it. I'm not going to sit here and cry foul about these movies going to HBO Max, because it's the bigger audience, and streaming is the present and the future. So, I look at it that way. Before I get into the Marvel part of this, I did want to mention, I talked earlier about the four movies that DC is going to have in 2022. Well, we have a title officially for all of them now, because we know that The Batman is coming out in March of 2022. We know that Black Adam is coming out July of 2022, and we know that The Flash solo film is coming out in November of 2022. And now we know that the DC film that will be released in December 2022 is called Aquaman and the Lost Kingdom. This is per James Wan's Instagram. He posted a picture of a note, like a note card on top of a table for a production meeting. That was, it had either happened or it was happening. And, you know, director, James Wan. Title, Aquaman and the Lost Kingdom. There you have it. There's been a couple of things with this. First of all, I dig the title. Title's awesome. I really like it. It's so much better than, you know, Aquaman 2 or Aquaman colon whatever. You know, the colon title is just like, well, I'll live with them, but can you think of something a bit more inventive, like making a phrase like this, Aquaman and the Lost Kingdom? That's cool. I like that. But there have been a couple of other things with this. People have noted, looking at the image of this from James Wan's Instagram, looking at the image of the title, they've noted that, oh, the typeface, the font, like the scenery behind it looks darker. That could signify a change in tone. I'm not going to go that far, but you could be right. Who knows? Could be definitely a change in tone. It would make sense because, you know, I don't want to say that Aquaman was like overtly like positive. I mean, it dealt with some serious issues and some family drama, but yes, it was a brighter film. There's no question about it. The color palette was definitely lighter and brighter. Wan made that decision, creatively speaking. It doesn't have the same tones and hues and saturation that just the Zack Snyder's Justice League has, right? It's a different case. So maybe he's going in a different, darker direction with this one. We'll see. Who knows? I still haven't seen any of Wan's horror movies, so I really don't have anything else to judge this on. People that have seen The Conjuring and his other work can, you know, infer that. Cool. Awesome. The other thing that is being inferred from this is the fact that this, it was pointed out, I forget what account pointed this out, but the fact that Aquaman and the Lost Kingdom were referenced on the whiteboards for the Justice League sequels that, you know, we all know, or many of us know, were developed by Zack Snyder, Jim Lee, and the pariah, Geoff Johns. And, you know, so people were looking at that, and I think that this account, you know what, I need to look up exactly what account this was. I quote tweeted them a couple, you know, when this came out, because I was like, yeah, this is a kind of a no-brainer with respect to how this goes. But they were asking the question about whether or not you considered the Aquaman, you know, the first Aquaman film to be part of the Snyderverse canon. And my answer was yes, objectively so. It is part of the Snyderverse canon because, you know, look at the pattern of events. Look at, you know, how that movie ends. And, you know, look at how Zack Snyder's Justice League ends, rather. And I gotta go see my dad. And how it leads directly into him going to see his dad at the beginning of Aquaman. So, like, you know, as far as continuity goes, like, yes, it absolutely fits. It is part of that whole continuity. I think when people say Snyderverse, it's the DC Syndicate. That was the name of the account, the DC Syndicate. And they were like, you know, Aquaman and the Lost Kingdom was in the storyboard for that, so Aquaman 2 could be canon to Snyderverse if it happens. Do you consider Aquaman 1 to be canon? Well, yeah, it is. And there's evidence of that. And, you know, to me, I remember, you know, if anybody recalls earlier this year, when the Dallas event went up, the Dallas AT&T, the museum for Zack Snyder's Justice League went up, and they had all of the, you know, the costumes and the sets and the, you know, the artist renderings, and then there was an exhibit there with the whiteboards. The whiteboards were there. Remember that whole controversy about how people were taking pictures, posting them on Twitter, and within hours they were taken down. Warner Brothers wanted a cease and desist. They shut the exhibit down. It became a big, huge thing between them and AT&T, and finally it got reopened with the provision of you can't take pictures of the whiteboards. Why do you think Warner Brothers was so squirrely and freaking out about people taking pictures of the whiteboards? It's pretty clear, and it's pretty obvious to me, they're using elements from the whiteboards in the future of their DCEU plans. And I'm not going to read what the whiteboard said about The Lost Kingdom, just in case I'm completely right, which I think I am. And this whiteboard more than likely has what's going to be in Aquaman and the Lost Kingdom by James Wan. Would not surprise me one bit. Because why else would you freak out over it? If it was really a dead idea, if it was a whiteboard full of dead ideas that nobody was going to do anything with, then why are you making a big deal out of it? No, Warner Brothers called attention to it by freaking out over it. They're using this stuff for the future of the DCEU. And I know a lot of Snyder fans are going to cry foul on that, and they're going to say, why wouldn't you just do the Justice League sequels if you were just going to use his stuff, and how can you even do that? That's not fair. Well, the thing is, it kind of is fair, because as much as it may seem ethically wrong, you know, given everything that they've done to him, yes, in that regards, it is ethically wrong. But Zack Snyder does not own the licensing for DC. Warner Brothers does, and he developed these ideas for properties that they own, meaning he was on the clock for them. They can do whatever they want with him, you know, if they choose to. So there's that aspect of it. And quite frankly, you know, I've heard people, you know, the apologists that want to tell me, oh, the Justice League sequels would cost far too much money. It's ridiculous to expect them to do that. Well, this is their answer, right? Their answer to that is, well, they can take these ideas and spin them off into different films and do them cheaper, right? And Aquaman was, well, that was $150 million. Do we expect that the sequel, do we expect that Aquaman and the Lost Kingdom is going to be equal to that budget or more? Well, I would think probably equal or less, to be honest with you. That's what I think. And I don't know if it's going to be a more intimate film. It may or may not be. You don't have to establish Atlantis the same way that you did in the first film because it's already there. There's going to be some more intricate stuff. And obviously the underwater stuff and all the great visual effects work that they did there is going to go into it. But there have also been more, you know, innovations, you know, the volume stuff, you know, and some more of the VFX innovations that have happened just in the last 3 years alone will probably benefit James Wan and the crew on this one. So we'll see. But no, it's clear to me that those whiteboards are future ideas that Warner Brothers or others are going to develop for the DC Extended Universe going forward. So it does not surprise me that, you know, that connection was made with respect to this title and what was in the whiteboards. And whatever side, you know, you can take the side of that's awful. I can't believe they're just taking Snyder's ideas, even though, again, the whiteboards were developed by him, Johns, and Jim Lee. So it wasn't just Snyder that developed those ideas, right? And on top of that, there is something to be said for the other angle of this, which is to say, oh, well, they still respect the ideas that he was a part of. You know, it's not like they're just tossing everything out. They're looking at it going, well, we still like your ideas. So in a weird roundabout way, it is like this begrudging respect that they're going to give him, even though they won't publicly say it to him. They're not publicly going to apologize. They're not publicly going to give any mea culpas or respect to him. But this is indirectly like, oh, yeah, we respect your ideas at the end of the day. And, you know, it's the closest to a we were wrong we're ever going to get from the studio with respect to this. Because Emmerich and the others are never going to admit the egregious errors that they've made in the last 5 years alone. So perhaps seeing the future of the Snyderverse, and also, as I've mentioned before, knowing that the Snyderverse is going to continue regardless of whatever reboots occur in the Flash film, knowing that the DCEU will be the Snyderverse as long as it exists. As long as there's a DCEU, there is a Snyderverse. Knowing that will be some comfort to us while Zack Snyder builds his empire on Netflix. Oh yes, we all know about that. So here, let's change some gears here. Let's go into some Marvel. I was going to lead off with this, but I'll talk about it now because in the past I've talked about these shows, you know, like the Disney Plus MCU shows when they're over so that I could talk about the entirety of the show. And I am going to do that with this show, but I did want to, I watched the premiere of Loki and I did want to talk about it for a bit because Loki was the show, you know, of the trailers that we saw for like WandaVision, The Falcon and the Winter Soldier, and Loki. Loki was the one that I said, okay, no, I don't know what this show's about and I'm very intrigued because what I saw in that trailer intrigued me a great deal. So it's like, all right, well, what kind of start are they off to? Answer is a good one. Subjectively speaking, a good start. I dig this show. Like, so far, you know, the premise of what they did with the first episode, and I'll just, you know, throw out a mild spoiler warning out there now for anybody that hasn't watched it yet. But basically what happens in this first episode is, you know, we see turns out to be a great recreation. I imagine they used outtakes and other stuff. I know there's an article in terms of how they did this and any type of reshoots that were necessary to recreate the 2012 Avengers scene, which, you know, don't get me wrong, they did that for Avengers Endgame, and that's really what this is supposed to be. This isn't really Avengers 2012. This is supposed to be Avengers Endgame because we're seeing what happened when Loki stole the Tesseract. When he stole the Tesseract in Endgame, you know, like, it opened the door for more stuff to be done with Loki, but how are they going to proceed with that? Well, now we're going to see how they are proceeding with it. And the idea is, you know, he's a time variant. He is not supposed to be that. That is not what is supposed to happen. What happened in Endgame was supposed to happen. Him stealing the Tesseract was not supposed to happen. And the time variant authority is now what is dealing with him with respect to this. And it's interesting. I really like the this first episode was really just about setting the groundwork for that and bringing Loki up to speed on what's happened since then, because he didn't know. He legitimately didn't know, and that was what I was looking for. I was like, okay, how much of what happened to his prime timeline self is he going to be aware of? And the answer is everything. He knows everything now. He watched Thanos choke him out, break his neck. He watched that happen. You know, the scene that I, to this day, I still remember the audible gasps in the theater when we watched Infinity War when that happened. It was a shocking death for a lot of people. And I know some people that were still saying even after that, like, well, no, he could still come back. There's still a way. He doesn't have to be alive. He could have faked his death. Oh, no, he's dead. And this show clearly cements that Loki is dead, because this is now time variant Loki. It's the only way that Loki exists now. Time variant Loki has now, you know, diverged. And this whole episode is just about him coming to grips with his existence. And not just his existence now in this new paradigm, but his existence period, right? And he does some really awesome work. Tom Hiddleston does some really awesome work with Owen Wilson, who plays Agent Mobius, which I like that, obviously, you know, akin to the Mobius strip is what that is. There's some really good work, you know, Mobius pressing Loki about, you know, why does he do what he does? And, you know, like, does he enjoy causing pain and suffering? What is really his purpose? You know, like, basically digging into all the questions that any one of us would have about a one-note villain in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, or in any universe in that regard. And Loki isn't a one-note villain. He's never been a one-note villain, but he's acted within one-note parameters, right? He's always had other dimensions, but they haven't quite dug into his other dimensions quite like it looks like they're going to in this show, just based off of the first episode. And I have to call that out. I have to point that out, because even though I've enjoyed Hiddleston's portrayal as Loki in the MCU, it still feels like, well, they've kept him surface level, even though they've given him this range, they've given him this, you know, these emotional connections with Thor, and, you know, they've given him all these dramatic scenery to chew, like, at different points, whether it's in the Thor movies or in Avengers or wherever, right? Like, they've given him, like, something of a playground with this character, but they've also kept him within the framework of being a villain. And now, this show is going to examine all of that, and it's going to probe his mind deeper, and it's going to really get to the heart of why he is who he is, and why he does what he does. And this whole first episode, that's all it was about. It was great. It was awesome. I loved it's another signifier to me that phase four of the MCU so far could end up being the best phase. You know, and my favorite phase of the MCU to this point is phase one. You know, the for lack of a better way to put it, the film phase, because the first five films of the MCU were all, the first five movies of the MCU were all shot on film, you know, and then Avengers, the season finale, if you will, was filmed digitally with the Arri Alexa. And that's when they, you know, the digital paradigm went into play. And listen, I'm not against digital. I'm just making a point there. But, like, I felt that the MCU, like, their strongest work as a collective phase was the first phase, because those movies were kind of unencumbered, and, you know, they were in the early stages, and they were doing their own thing, and they were starting to try and set a tone. So there were definite things they were doing with, like, character dynamics and, like, drama and, like, camera placement. And there were things that they were doing in that first phase that, you know, they went on autopilot for in a couple of ways with Phase 2 and 3, and now it looks like with Phase 4, post-Infinity Saga, they're getting back to doing some, you know, some of the, not crazier stuff, but just some of the less cookie-cutter stuff, you know, when it comes to the cinematography, when it comes to some of these character dynamics, when it comes to, like, the actual storytelling, like, I am seeing some emotional depth here. And it's not that these actors are not capable of it. All of them are, and Hiddleston, of course, is. But I feel like even in this episode of Loki, he's gone to places with that character that we just... He danced around in the Thor movies, and he danced around in Avengers, but he never actually got there. And now he's there already in one episode of Loki. That's great. I love that. That's fantastic. And I am looking forward to seeing what the rest of this series holds with respect to that. I love the music. I absolutely love the music. And I, man, I had remembered her name, and now I have to look up her name again. I've got to, you know, hit the Google here and find out the name. Natalie Holt. Yes, Natalie Holt. Fantastic job. Love the music. Absolutely love. She's a British composer and a violinist, and you know, she's my age. Oh my goodness. Seriously, her 39th birthday is in like a couple of weeks. That is insane. Wow. I need to get my crap together. Anyway, she is a British composer and a violinist, and what I love what she did with respect to, at least in this first episode, and I hope she continues this, is the great blend of orchestral and electronics. It gives it this eerie feel, right? Just this kind of otherworldly feel to the whole work. And I saw some people say Doctor Who. They made comparisons, and it's like, listen, okay, this isn't Doctor Who. Doctor Who is in a different category with respect to it. We're not going to hit the easy button and just say, oh, it's time travel and it feels eerie. It must be like Doctor Who. No, but the sound is there. I will say that. The sound, and there are definitely elements that are evocative of that in there. No question about it. I really, really dig the musical choices that were made by Natalie Holt. I look forward to the rest of them for this season. Gugu Mbatha-Raw is Gugu Mbatha-Raw. She's great. So is Wonmi Masaku, who I didn't know until like a couple weeks ago that she was even going to be in this series. And it's like, wow. So let's see. A couple years ago, you know, she was the African woman that testified against Superman in BVS. And just recently, she was Ruby, Letty's sister in Lovecraft Country, and man, did she have some incredible episodes, man. Her story arc, if you've never seen Lovecraft Country, oh, so good. So incredibly good. Yes, love it. And now she's in the MCU. Outstanding. I'm very happy for Wonmi Masako on that one. And the other person, I was not expecting to see this person in the show, but Eugene Cordero. I have come to know him recently because he's the voice of Rutherford on Lower Decks. And it was cool to see him. He's in the TVA. It was cool to see. He was like the goofy guy that, you know, had control, had the Tesseract and had like a drawer full of Infinity Stones, which that was like the eye-opener for Loki that, okay, wherever you are and whoever you're dealing with, it's not an illusion because even Infinity Stones don't work here. So clearly, they are as powerful as Mobius is saying they are. And that was like the eye-opener for him. And it was just cool to see Eugene Cordero there because I really dug him as Rutherford on Star Trek Lower Decks. And it's cool to see him in live action. I imagine we're going to see more of his character. We'll see. But yeah, that was cool. And also, the voice of Miss Minutes, Tara Strong. Yes, the irrepressible Tara Strong. The voice of Harley Quinn for a number of Teen Titans, Powerpuff Girls, Fairly Odd Parents. I mean, her voice acting credits are insane. She is a voice acting titan. So why not get her to play Miss Minutes? The crazy like 50s animated voice in the 50s video that was explaining what the TVA and the timekeepers were to Loki, you know, before he stood trial. Yeah, that was all. It was really good. It was. This first pilot episode for Loki, really good. And again, I think it further signifies that Phase 4 really is going to be a strong phase. A really strong phase so far for the MCU. We're about to see how it goes cinematically speaking, when we get back to the movie theater. And yeah, it'll start with Black Widow. It was always meant to start with Black Widow. So we'll see how that goes, and then it'll go into Shang-Chi and The Legend of the Ten Rings, and then Eternals, and then, of course, Spider-Man No Way Home at the end of the year. But these shows, man, I mean, WandaVision was fantastic. The Falcon and the Winter Soldier was outstanding, and now here we go. We got another one. Next 5 weeks, we're all going to be talking about Loki, and yes, I will revisit this series when it, you know, is at the end, when the season is concluded, and we can talk about it then. And I will definitely have that conversation. But yeah, so far, pilot episode, outstanding. Very, very good. Really enjoyed it. All right, before I take off for the day, there was this Netflix Geeked event that had some cool information, obviously. And there's a ton of stuff that I want to see on Netflix, like with respect to, you know, the Jay Oliva's new thing, Tracy, that just came out. I want to see that. But they also had some announcements for that new Norse mythology project that Jay Oliva and Zack Snyder are working on, the one that we've known about for a while. It is now official. The voice cast is official. And it's an amazing voice cast if you haven't seen it. John Noble. And John Flippin' Noble, seriously. Like, that's an actor that, like, I haven't seen him. I mean, that's Walter from Fringe. I have loved his work for quite some time. And then he played Mollus in the third season of Legends of Tomorrow on the DCCW. Like, he's Odin. That's the voice of Odin. That's going to be amazing. Corey Stahl is going to be in this. Jamie Chung, Christopher Hivju, who, you know, people will know him from Game of Thrones. Big dude with the red beard. One of the wildlings. Lauren Cohan. Hey, there we go. So many people have wanted Lauren Cohan to be, you know, to be Martha Joker, to be Martha in an extended period in the DCEU. Here she goes, working with Zack Snyder. Peter Stormare is working with him. Rahul Kohli, which, yes, plenty of people have pointed out the trash talking, you know, and some of the snide comments that he's made about Snyder and the Snyder fans in the past. Well, that's all water under the bridge now, isn't it? For sure. No, again, these actors don't care about rivalries. They just want to work. For sure. Sylvia Hoeks, who was a fantastically horrible villain that I was very happy to see get vanquished in Blade Runner 2049. She's Sigrid. She's also in C. And I need to watch C, especially now, because apparently Dave Bautista is playing Jason Momoa's brother in the second season of that show. So it's like, okay, I need to go watch the first season. But yeah, Twilight of the Gods is this Norse mythology-inspired series by Zack Snyder and Jay Oliva that we'd heard about for a while. The casting for that looks amazing. We got some new, you know, tidbits, like some little stuff about the second season of The Witcher. There's going to be a WitcherCon on July 9th, which is the same day that Black Widow comes out, interestingly enough. So there's that. There's going to be a ton more information on that. And Netflix really seems like they are trying to get into franchise mode, and you know they had this big Geeked event to announce a bunch of new stuff. They're doing some big stuff with Resident Evil, which apparently includes Lance Reddick from Fringe and The Wire, and John Wick is going to be the new Albert Wesker. And like, I don't know if is it the show or the movie. I think he's going to be in the movie, like the live action movie that they're going to do for Netflix. And it's like, wow, that's amazing. Like, Netflix is you know, they're gearing some stuff up, and it's interesting. You know, that they're doing this because they want to keep pace. They see what everybody else is doing. They see how the streaming wars are heating up, and everybody is chasing against them. You know, Disney Plus is chasing them. HBO Max is chasing them. Amazon is chasing them, and major moves are being made, and they want to stay out ahead. They're the leaders, Netflix is, in terms of the subscribers and in terms of the reach and, you know, how visible it is to the general audience. It's still a case, you know, when I talk to people about, you know, the people that still tell me there are too many apps and it's just going to be cable again. And I'm like, well, first of all, you're right. Streaming is just going to end up being cable over the internet, and we're going to all be using Ethernet cables instead of coax. But people make choices as far as what apps they have, and usually it's at maximum three, right? And the way that it goes is they have Netflix and then something else and then maybe something else, right? But it's usually Netflix and something else. It's usually how it goes. Netflix is the standard when it comes to that. And they're not perfect. They do many a thing that, you know, have irritated a number of people with respect to canceling shows and, you know, putting out certain kinds of content that people don't necessarily dig or think is all that great. But still, they are the leader. They are most certainly the leader. And, you know, while the others are trying to chase up on them and you know, gain ground, they want to stay ahead. And so when they do events like Netflix Geeked, you know, to get people hyped and they started advertising cons for their own franchises like The Witcher, that's going to help try and keep them forward and try and keep them, you know, at the top of the food chain with respect to the streaming wars. So it's very interesting to see. And of course, they're in the middle of their, you know, their big movie releases for this year. I am so behind on those. I really need to get on that and just kind of get caught up on all the new movies that they've had like this year that I really wanted to see and, you know, get ready for the second half of the year. Cause man, the year is almost half over. We're already in June. Year's almost half over, and there is plenty of content to watch there, as well as on other services for sure. So yeah, just wanted to talk about that a bit and, you know, get into a little bit of what Netflix is doing and where they're headed. But I think that is going to do it for this particular episode of The Flightcast. As always, thank you so much for listening to this show. Please do not hesitate to let me know what any of you think about any of this stuff, you know, with respect to the whole Blue Beetle thing. You know, how do you feel in terms of reframing the conversation about streaming versus theatrical? Where are you at? Do you agree with me? Or do you think that it's just another example of racism, you know, why these films are going to HBO Max? If you want to have a rational discussion about it, we can. I had some. Not every discussion ends in a block or a mute. I definitely have rational discussions where at the end we say agree to disagree and we move forward. Plenty of you listening to this show, I probably had a discussion like that with. So we can talk about that if you like. What do you think about Aquaman and the Lost Kingdom? Is that a cool title for you? Did you see the Loki premiere? What did you think about that? And hey, you know what? Drop some Superman thoughts too, because it is still Superman Day. Hopefully when you're listening to this, I don't know. It depends on when Apple Podcast posts this, but this is going to be live on Superman Day. But for some people, every day is Superman Day, so what does it really matter, right? Either way. But don't hesitate to let me know what you guys think about that and anything else. I can be reached by email at ray@theflightcast.com. I'm also on Twitter with the Flightcast page. I've got an Instagram for the Flightcast. And, of course, this show, my other episodes, and my blog posts can all be found at theflightcast.com. So thanks a lot, guys. Take care. Stay safe out there. And we'll see you next week. Take it easy.